So I think each of us is really going to talk about how different it's our voice. And really, I wanted to also talk about what it has meant for me to also join the voice of the IOM, because I think there's a lot of resemblance. Let me start by saying, I mean, I've been all over the place. Let's put it that way. I started with divorced women, have done disaster studies, have done sex workers. I was very interested into sex workers and what happened to their lives and why they didn't have opportunities. I've also been very interested in immigrant populations and the life of immigrant populations and how to get service delivery that fits their needs. I've done now work with the elderly. So you can see, and also with children. So when people were promoting me, they were asking me, like, my God, but you're all over the place. You don't really have a trajectory, a real focus. And I used to say, really? I think I have a lot of focus. The same things are what matters to me. I'm really interested in understanding how institutional, social, individual, and neighborhood factors are associated with behavioral health care. I'm really interested in how ethnicity, race, culture, and context relate to behavioral health, service delivery, and service disparities, and the role of social and health policies, patient activation, and patient and provider empowerment and interaction in getting what people deserve, not what they get. So I really think I'm very focused. I don't see why you think I'm not focused. So let me tell you a little bit of my trajectory in research, because there's a lot of things I really have learned by following your own voice. The first one has to do, I was very lucky that early enough I started a study about managed care, the impact of managed care. Puerto Rico had this huge health reform that no one was really interested in studying. But I was lucky enough that we had collected two waves of data of poor Puerto Ricans in the island before health reform. And then health reform happened, and I had a natural experiment to see, well, what had happened to them. And it was just like the perfect study to do. So on the one hand, the people pre-managed care, basically the government owned all facilities. And they actually offer all the public health, and people, the primary care providers and the behavioral health providers, were actually contracted by the state. Then after managed care, they actually took all that money and privatized the system and actually gave the money to insurance companies that actually took different areas of the island and provided the care directly, and they were capitated, so you would get an X amount for each enrollee that you had, and that was happening. So what happened? This was really a tense area. On the one hand, people were saying, this is really going to fix the system. On the other hand, the unions were saying, this is going to be a disaster. This is going to be a real disaster. So what I found is that although people thought it was the panacea, and on the other hand, people thought this is going to be a disaster, neither was true. It didn't really change at all. So there was this massive change, but actually the results showed that it was not that different. Okay? And this actually made me the number one enemy of everyone. So on the one hand, the people from the government were, you know, super mad at the idea that I maybe had some political agenda and wanted to show how health reform had not worked. And on the other hand, the people from the unions and, you know, the public sector said, oh, you know, she must have it all wrong. There's no way that, you know, this is not harmful to me. So one of the things I learned very early on is you have to stay with whatever you think is the truth, no matter how it comes. But I can tell you, I presented in some seminars where people were very angry either way. So you can't see it right there, but we did a paper on system cost effectiveness. And what we showed is that really the introduction of managed care, although it slightly diminished cost, there were really no improvements in effectiveness. We didn't provide better care as a result of managed care. And actually, the reasons are very important. It was, you can't do system changes. And if you don't really allocate more resources, you don't really monitor and create accountability, your chances of getting a change are minimal. And that's exactly what we found. It's interesting because with the IOM, not like Rosemary says here, 5 years in an IOM committee where we actually studied the needs of the military and all the changes they were doing in response to the military coming back home after the Iraq and Afghanistan war. And one of the things that we found from doing that study is how changing just the system supposedly without really trying to improve quality improvements, without really trying to put more than the institutional change, but actually the capacity change in the providers, really doesn't move you that long, that you really need to make other changes important. So again, you can't do system change without monitoring, accountability, or added supports. It really requires a lot more to really translate it to system cost effectiveness. Demand for healthcare driven by individual need is going to be minimally altered if you just change the system without changing everyone within that system in a transformative way. I did another study where I learned another big thing, and this was a very important study. And actually, Hortensia was my consultant and actually did a lot of things, her knowledge. This was studying women in public housing projects that were young, 18 to 35 years of age. It was a very interesting study because what we did is we actually did a random sample of women living in housing projects that were very close, half a mile from coping areas, meaning where people shoot drugs. And these were high-risk housing neighborhoods. And you learn a lot about how you are so protected in your own life that you don't know that there's another life out there. You actually don't see the world. It's like Blue Velvet, I think it is. You know, like you have to get out of your community to see what's happening out there. And we follow women for 2 years to try to see what happens to these women living in these high-risk areas as compared to the ones that are already in the coping areas. How do they do incarceration, prostitution, HIV, depression, and mortality? And what we found is that low education, unemployment, current alcohol use, and severe partner violence were very predictive of who started getting into drug use. So it was not the idea that women enter into drug use and then they go into partner violence. Actually, we found that women that were exposed to partner violence were the ones likely to then over time enter into drug use. The other thing we found is, you know, dramatic difference between self-report and toxicological tests. And what we find is that drug use is so stigmatized in our society that we don't allow people to actually seek help. And so prevention programs really must, if you think about our findings, we should be focusing on social mobility, on empowerment, and mitigating violence more than anything else if we really want to deal with drug use. So I just wanted to show you from the paper, one of the most interesting findings was seeing that if women receive public assistance, if they receive public assistance, it dramatically decreased their likelihood of drug use. So having public assistance, when you think that now, especially now in this cutting costs, we're thinking of actually reducing the entitlements to people and how the reduction of entitlements, things like WIC were very important for helping women struggle with a very difficult life circumstances. And that we're thinking of cutting this, what are the implications? What are the consequences? So policies that aim to decrease public entitlement programs may actually increase the risk for hard drug use among these populations. Rather than having policies to reduce public entitlement, we should think about programs of helping women achieve economic independence, financial security, that allows them to flee from their oppression. And it's interesting because in the IOM, we have been discussing exactly that in the Public Health Board. One of our members just presented this fantastic view of how public health is the key to trying to get a lot of our social ills. It's not more putting more money on medical care. That's not going to get us there. It's really not going to get us. It's actually putting money in public policy. and public health programs. The last thing I want to discuss is understanding how ethnicity, race, culture, and context relate to health service delivery and service disparity. We did I want to tell you two things. One, we did a paper very early on looking at income difference in persons seeking health services, and we compared the U.S. with Ontario and the Netherlands. And what we found is that the U.S., if you're low income, you're very likely to get services in the human and social services for your mental health and not through psychologists and psychiatrists. In the Netherlands, if you're middle income, you are less likely to get a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but it was not the people that were poor. And in Canada, it really didn't make any difference. Your income, you got the same care no matter what. I don't have to tell you what this is the learning lesson here, but this is an important issue. In the IOM Disparities Committee, we've actually discussed how geography and public health approaches to population health are crucial for understanding disparities. So it's not only thinking about what people do, but actually where they live that makes a difference. And then, you know, I'm going to go into the NLAS, the National Latino and Asian American Study, because this was an epidemiologic study I also participated with, included a lot of Latinos and Asians. But what's really interesting that we found in the NLAS is how, consistent with the immigrant paradox, U.S.-born Latinos were at higher risk of disorder than the immigrants, right? But when we disaggregated Latinos, what we found is not everyone is the same. Disaggregating is really crucial if we want to try to understand where are the disparities. And what we found there basically was that, for example, for Puerto Ricans, there was no immigrant paradox. We look very much like the U.S.-born Latinos, okay? However, for Mexicans, it was very different to see low rates of prevalence. But what I want to tell you is that generalizing to Latino groups and aggregating categories really masks a lot of the differences that you need to understand to actually monitor disparities. In the IOM Committee in Race, Language, and Culture, one of the first things we agreed is you need granular ethnicity. You really need to know where people are coming from if you're likely to try to understand disparities. So it's a very important component. And then finally, I think one of the things we've talked more is the importance of social and health policies, patient activation, patient-provider interaction as part of changing the dynamics. We actually have been looking a lot about this difference about how people interact if they're a minority in healthcare, how you get very, very different treatment. Coming through the door, that person just makes an idea of who you are and what they should ask you and how they should treat you. And this is important because the IOM actually brought so much about the importance of the patient and the provider in making that difference in service delivery. It really brought administrators and providers into the equation that it's not that people want to be treated that way, but it's actually how they get treated by that provider in interaction with whom they are. So patient activation is an area that I really become very interested. How to get the voice of the patient into the discussion of the agenda of care. Because people are not getting what they deserve. They're just getting what someone decides for them. So the social science field, I think, needs to explore alternative research paradigms and atypical research strategies. One of the things I like the most about being part of the IOM is that you get this group of multidisciplinary people that have different ideas about what is the solution to the problem, but they sit down and actually discuss different areas and come up with a report that sort of focuses on what are the most important things you need to do to change this problem. And it makes it so different. In contrast to the NIH, and I have to put my little line here, because Much of the research of the United States that is supported by the federal government is really directed at thinking about pathology. This thing that's out there that's like, you know, in a vacuum. But the idea of coming to communities and finding out why are we having those problems is really central. They see their mission as understanding basic science and less interest on the services and on the treatments and the community level. And so those priorities, as we know, have not really met the needs of the communities, by no means. And although they're supposedly interested in effective and rapid examination, when you look at what they're funding, it's so distant from where the communities are. You wonder, like, are those people ever going and talking to the community? Because it seems like we're living in two different worlds, one of NIH and one of the community. So I really think that the idea of not putting money into treatment adaptations, the idea of not studying multicultural populations, it's just like, where are they? So I think this is an important area for us to try to make a difference, because if not in the future, generations of scientists will say, how could well-meaning and highly educated researchers working in their usual circumstances, studying diverse populations of patients, create a pattern of studies that is not well suited to represent their problems and solutions to their service needs? Thank you.